Okay, we're here this afternoon with Sarah Nelson, the president of the AFA and a partner with CWA. We're joined today with Debbie Goldman and Hannah Goldman, who are also with this interview. Today's August 30th, 2024, and Sarah, you're at your home in the DC area, I presume?
Yes,
Right.
that's right.
Okay.
Washington, D.C., or another town?
Bethesda.
Thank you.
We'd like to start really at the beginning. Talk a little bit about your childhood, if you would, where you grew up, siblings, any sort of background information like that you can share with us.
Sure, yeah. I was born in Corvallis, Oregon, 1973. I'm the oldest of three kids in my family. Two younger brothers. And my parents, my mom grew up in Bend, Oregon, but went to Los Angeles to start her teaching career. She met my dad there. When they first met, he had just been drafted into the army. And so he went off to Alaska for a couple of years because of the end of basic training as he was getting ready to get his shots to go to Vietnam. They said, Nelson, your physical scores show that you'd be good in our biathlon unit, so we're going to send you to Alaska
Wow.
instead. Wow is right. That
Whew.
changed the whole
Yeah.
trajectory of his life, and he was actually haunted the rest of his life because his younger brother was sent to Vietnam with, real horrific situation. But he actually became a Christian Scientist. My mom grew up a Christian Scientist in Bend, and that was because her mother had come from one of the early families in Minnesota who was a Christian. They were Christian Scientists. They were very intellectual. My grandmother got her master's in chemistry.
Wow.
One of my I think great aunts was one of the first to serve on the judiciary in Minnesota. A lot of focus on education and higher education, and also women getting an education and being self-sufficient. But my grandmother met my grandfather and moved out to Oregon. My grandfather had gone to Oregon when he was quite young, 5 years old, and he had tuberculosis. And the diagnosis from doctors up and down the West Coast was that he was going to die at an early age. And his mother had grown up a Christian Scientist, and she said, I'm not going to accept that. And so they went to a Christian Science practitioner in Portland. He was healed of tuberculosis. And so my family had, very, very strong experiences to ground the religion in that way in the family. And so when my father was in Alaska, he saw that there was a Christian Science practitioner. He took it up. My mom at the time had become a little bit rebellious and maybe was rebelling against the religion a little bit. And then he came back and she's like, great, no fun. But they were a match for raising a family. And my mom got hired in a new teacher position in Oregon. My dad wanted to finish up his master's degree in physical education in Oregon, and they moved up, and not long after that had me. My dad had to provide for the family, so he went into the local lumber mill. And the early years of my life, I remember him working in the lumber mill. I remember the smell of sawdust when he would come home, and also the smell of glue because he was in a plywood plant. He actually lost part of his pinky finger in that mill. But he ultimately went into the sales office and never became a physical education teacher because at the same time, Oregon cut property taxes, and which cut the school budgets. And so we saw a lot of cuts. My mom was a music teacher. We were lucky that her job was spared. And so she w actually had a union contract, but we did not talk about that in my house. I think that I got a strong sense of justice from my parents, and the reason that I focused on the religion is because it was formed by a woman, Mary Baker Eddy. And the description of well, the purpose of the religion is to understand that we're made in God's image and likeness, and therefore we've got to reflect all the qualities of God. And one of the ways that she describes that is talking about male and female qualities as being equal, and our purpose in life is to try to be to actually express all of those qualities. So I was taught that there, you know, certain qualities are not stronger or more important than others. You're not a whole being unless you're expressing all of this. And I just never had the sense that women couldn't do anything that men could do, other than the fact that my parents grew up in the 50s. And if I really want to think about it, my brothers did the outside chores with my dad and I did all the inside chores with my mom. So there are some discrepancies there. But I think about it in my fourth grade class when my teacher asked all of us what we wanted to be when we grew up. And a lot of people said, you know, firefighters and all kinds of jobs that people are used to hearing from kids. And I really was like, I don't know. So I said, President of the United States. And the response from the teacher was, oh, you want to be the first woman president of the United States? And I didn't really key into this until, you know, decades later when I was thinking about the story. But at the time, in my little 9-year-old brain, I said, well, I don't want to do too hard things. Okay, I'll be a teacher. So I have to be president and the first one? No. So that was really my upbringing, and my parents also taught us that money was not for things, it was for experiences. And every summer vacation, especially because my mom was a teacher and we had those summers to do a lot of things. Of course, we were signed up for all the parks and recs activities. I can remember, you know, starting tennis at 7 a.m. and then having swimming and then having softball in the afternoon. And then, you know, we'd play with all the kids on the in the neighborhood. We'd play hot box and we'd play Mississippi hiding in everybody's yards. And then we'd make makeshift tents and camp out. And we did a lot of camping, but we also did a lot of traveling with our families in the summers. And typically those travels would be long car trips where we would also camp at KOA campgrounds. And it was a big treat that one of the nights we'd get to stay in a hotel where there was a pool. Woo! So money was for experiences and traveling and meeting other people and being curious about the world. Those are the things that my parents gave me. And they gave me a very, we grew up in Corvallis, Oregon, which is a university town, and the big employers were the university or Hewlett Packard. All of my friends were certainly focused on education, but there's no private schools really in Oregon other than like very small Catholic school and just a smattering of handful. But otherwise, the focus is public education. Everybody goes and everybody participates. And there's not a lot to push to see what your biases are in Oregon, especially in Corvallis, Oregon. So I didn't really learn until much later when I was going to college in Southern Illinois and had a very progressive and awesome ed department that really pushed us, had us reading Jonathan Kozol and took us into inner city St. Louis schools and less privileged communities also, and made sure that we were really stretching our own experiences, that I learned that I had been really taught to be racist. And that was really a horrifying thought to me. I remember sitting up all night actually with some of my dorm mates and just talking about it and sobbing and crying that oh my gosh, I've been taught to think less of someone because of the color of their skin, or to be afraid, or whatever it may be. And so that experience at school, both being on a dry campus and still having a lot of real clear boundaries in my learning life, but then being pushed on my own education and my own understanding of the world, was a really good baseline for what came next. I had a strong sense of justice growing up in a small town, and believing that you can do anything that you set your mind to. I should just note one other thing. My mom started a children's choir when I was in sixth grade, my brother was in fourth grade, and my younger brother was quite a few years behind. But she started that because she didn't want to drive the hour to Eugene, where the children's choir was. So she just started it. And she started this huge organization that grew to give kids experience to travel all over the world and sing and interface with other cultures and have these amazing experiences. And then when my dad went to judge the biathlon at the 1980 Winter Olympics and he didn't take her, she started her own singing telegram business. And by the time he came back, we had people in ape suits coming in and out of our house. And we had a helium tank in our living room. And we had an answering machine that was going off every few hours saying, I'm the girl from the Songbird Express. I'd love to talk to you, but I'm out of the nest. So leave your name and number when you hear the tone, and I'll call you right back. So stay by your phone. Thanks for calling. And then, I mean, I could just hear it going off all hours of the day and night. And so, she also definitely taught me that if something doesn't exist, create it. So anyway, off to college, planned to be a secondary teacher, ultimately after sort of.
So what took you to Southern Illinois?
Oh, well, it's a small liberal arts school that is not run by the church, but it was based in Christian Science. So there was also that connection. And they did a weekend review of the school in late in junior year. And you could pay $50 and the school would pay for the rest of it. So for me, it was like, oh, I get a vacation for $50, but then I ended up loving it and decided that that was the only place that I wanted to apply to. It was on the bluffs of the Mississippi. It was gorgeous. It was designed by Bernard Maybach, the famous architect. Yeah. So it was Tudor style everywhere.
What
couldn't
was
have
the
been
name?
More. Bernard Maybach was the architect.
What was the name of the school?
Oh, Principia College.
Principia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now that you've taken a breath, that was quite a happy childhood, it sounds like to me. I'd like you to talk a little more when you said you learned that you were taught to be a racist. That's a pretty powerful statement. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think that what I mean by that is that I was taught well, first of all, I was taught to think that somebody who didn't look like me was strange or different, or you might not know what their motives are. I mean, I think fear-based, right? And then also just biases. I don't mean to be to wish harm on someone else or to be pushed to think, to say explicitly that someone is less important than you or less valuable than you, but all of the little biases that you don't realize, like for example, whenever a welfare program was talked about, there would always be a picture of a Black family or a Black person. And I realized through the education process. Well, going to one of the family's homes for dinner one night, there was a girl who was in high school, and so only a few years different from my age. And she talked about that week going with her girlfriend. This was a middle-class home, actually, a home that was much nicer than the one that I grew up in, with two professors who were the parents in the home. And this teenage girl talked about going shopping at the Limited that I was used to going where I was used to going shopping. And she talked about the experience of being followed around by the shopkeeper and given the impression that the shopkeeper thought that they were there to steal something. And so some of it was understanding my own privilege, understanding that if I got pulled over by the police for speeding, which might have happened once or twice, that it was always sort of a game to me to see if I could get out of the ticket as opposed to, you know, a potential existential threat. And so it was through those stories and understanding my own privilege and also my own implicit bias that had been shown to me through textbooks and through television commercials and online, even sitcoms, just all of the visuals, or bias against people from different regions. I mean, I think about why should I think that someone is worth anything less than I'm worth because, you know, they're from West Virginia and they had lost a bunch of work there. And so there was a lot of poverty. So I think that's really what I mean, is that it was all of that, that I learned much, much later, was not just about race. It was really all of these social constructs to make us afraid of people who are not like us or not from where we're from, to keep the working class in check. And so, you know, full circle, I realized that racism and sexism especially were some of the key tools of the elite to try to keep the masses from joining together and understanding our common humanity and our common struggles.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that. And let me just ask again. I mean, you grew up in Corvallis, very white, very protected kind of environment, and then you're exposed to more. The construct that you now said that this was designed to keep the working class divided, did that insight come in college or later?
Oh, later, certainly later. In college, it was more of a sting that here I had, especially I think because of the religious background, and working so hard to be our better selves, to be more godlike. Or more Christ-like, obviously that can't mean that I would think that someone is, that I should be afraid of someone, or that I would think that they were somehow worth less than me or shouldn't have the same privileges that I have, or, you know, so it was more of a sting at the time. Something that I couldn't reconcile. Or understand, you know, where that came from. And so, yes, it wasn't until later that I really understood the real forces in capitalism that brought me to a much deeper understanding, in terms of wrestling with that capitalism, but then also doing organizing work where you have to break through any of these barriers or fears in order to build power for people to take on what is otherwise all of the money and control that then assumes the power through that money and control.
Wow. So let's dial it back to college again, and so you're going for a degree in secondary education. Is that what you started to say?
Yes, a degree in secondary education, mostly because I couldn't imagine having to do bulletin boards all the time.
Right, and because there wasn't a major in being president, I guess.
I had left the president idea.
Oh, okay, all right. So that was gone.
Quite a while
okay.
before.
Okay. Yeah. But you've got like these really remarkable female role models that you've grown up around. I mean, between your mother and your grandmother and your aunt, that have said, look, you really can do anything. So how do you migrate then from college into your next step in your career? What's that next on the agenda there?
So the only thing that I would say about that is that my younger brother, especially my middle brother, was very clear that he wanted to be in politics. That he, I mean, his friends all went to Bowie State, and they would sit around talking about, oh, I would never inhale because that was, the discussion at the time. Of course not. I just remember all their sort of pretentious discussions in the house and thinking, ugh, well, I'm gonna live my life. Not that I was necessarily into like smoking weed or anything, but just, being listening to them constraining themselves because they wanted to be able to say on a stage at some point that they were the person that they thought that people would want them to be. And that was the part that I couldn't reconcile and also just had no interest in. So I get through school and I had really a sort of amazing experience at school, including I'm going to do this part relatively quickly, but being date raped at school and having to grapple with that and not really even understanding for sure what had happened to me and being in denial and then being in an education class about adolescent development and going through a chapter the following semester, going through a chapter on date rape and everything that's being described is my experience. And I got very quiet when usually I participated very much in class and the professor recognized that something was happening with me, held me after the class and then stayed up with me all night and while I sort of worked through this and dealt with it. The reason that I bring that up is because that experience taught me what it is like to feel like someone is completely controlling you, to feel entirely powerless, and to not know if you're going to be okay, and to just also do everything you can to survive. So I think that I had to work through a lot of things myself there, but I think ultimately the experience allowed me to be much more empathetic and understanding about what people can struggle with and what it can feel like to feel completely out of control.
So you get your degree, and where do you go from there? What's next?
I still had to do my student teaching in the fall after I graduated.
Okay.
And so went back to St. Louis to do that, got lived in the city at the time with other ed majors. And then once I finished that up, got an apartment with another classmate I had graduated with in U City in St. Louis near WashU. And so I was substitute teaching. I had a job essentially lined up for the fall. I had it in my mind that everyone should wait tables in their lives. So I went and auditioned all of the, this is the way I saw it, auditioned all of the restaurants in St. Louis that I thought I might want to work at, and ultimately decided there was only one place I wanted to work, and that was California Pizza Kitchen because it was the only place that said that because of their workers, they didn't allow smoking. And so I wanted to work in a smoke-free environment. And they also had a training program for 2 weeks for their servers. And they had an English as a second language program for people who were coming to work there first in the kitchens and then encourage them to move up through the company. So I liked the whole philosophy. And it was also a place that my friends and I wanted to go to on the weekends when we were in college. So there was a lot of good feelings there, but I came and said, well, I have decided I'd like to work here. And they said, we don't have any openings. And I'm like, No, but I've chosen you, so you're going to have to hire me. And they were like, no. And so I just went back the next day. And I'm like, so do you have an opening for me yet? And I kept coming back for a few days. And they said, well, listen, you can be a host for a little while until the server position opens up. And that's what I did. And after a couple of weeks, I got into their training program to be a server. So I was working at California Pizza Kitchen around the clock, and then also working in a home store to try to get a discount for things that I needed for the apartment. And I worked for a while as a temp and ended up getting assigned to a medical insurance company. And they loved me. I would come in my tennis shoes and I could file faster than any other temp they'd ever had because I used to have a paper route, and so I would like make a game for myself to do these tasks and race myself, how quickly I could do it, but also give myself points for form too. For that was throwing the paper, not hitting the door, hitting the mat just right, and filing, clearly I needed to file correctly. But they had these huge files, and I would pick up the case folders, and I noticed after doing this for 3 weeks in a row that there were certain names that kept coming through, and they would be denied, 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 and then they would be filed. And I probably shouldn't admit this, but I got a little curious about some of these names that I had seen, and opened it up and saw that people were dealing with, horrific illnesses. And I didn't fully understand our medical system at the time, also because I was still practicing Christian Science. I had never even been to the doctor. But I remember taking note that, wow, why are they getting denied? They need help. These people need help. Anyway, it was those four jobs, and I was exhausted, and my best friend in college had become a flight attendant, and we had joked about it at the end of our senior year. And then she had been now flying for about 4 or 5 months, and she called me from Miami Beach on this very snowy day in February, and razzed me about the fact that she was standing there in the sand in her bikini talking to me on a payphone. And then she said, but actually, Sarah, this job is no joke. And she went on to describe the pay that was going to be more than my first year teacher pay. And I was worried also because student loans were coming and I didn't know how I was going to set up my classroom and pay my student loans and be able to live. And she talked about the flexibility on the job, and she talked about the health care that was also specific for women because women had been negotiating it. And she talked about the pension that you could take at age 50. She did not say, I have a union. And this is all in a contract, but obviously she was describing the contract that had been negotiated over 60 years at that point. And
And who is she flying for?
United. And so ironically, it was the pension at age 23 that got me to get in my car the next day because she said you can take it at age 50. And I thought, well, I'm 23, I'm exhausted. I would like to think about being done by 50, So yeah, drove to Chicago the next day, interviewed with United Airlines, and there was a process for getting hired, but in a matter of months, I was in training too, with United.
What year?
This is 1996.
And were they were hiring at that point?
They were hiring. They were actually hiring quite a lot. At the time, this is like the Silicon Valley boom, and United, especially, was doing well with their large San Francisco presence, and things were pretty good for the airlines, and so they were hiring a lot, and they actually had very significant requirements. You had to speak a second language at the time in order to get hired. I barely squeaked by on that with my 4 years of high school German and a couple years of college German to barely make it work. But I remember getting the job, and I also remember going to that first open house, and there were people who were standing in line crying because they wanted the job so badly. And I don't know anything about it, but I'm thinking, whoa. And They had been, you know, they had tried to get hired six or seven times. And so anyway, it was a little bit of a game for me, but I was not asking my parents for any help at the time. They were, first of all, I was very much becoming my own person and, having that little, you know, out of the nest, syndrome. But also I had gone to this expensive school, and they thought that I should use the education that I had gotten. And so later, when they got the travel benefits, that all went away. But I was not asking them for help. And so I remember going to the training. You had to dress in business attire every single day. You had to have your hair a certain way. You had to put on makeup. You had to do all of those things. And you could be released from training if you didn't have some of these things in place. And I had, I think, three shirts and two pairs of slacks that could pass for business attire. And I had to like wash them out in the sink and make everything work. And, and somehow made it through the training. And then during that training, actually, the few guys that we had in our class got the day off this one day because it was makeup day. And someone, a representative from Bobby Brown, came and showed us how to put on makeup. And if we could not show that we already had some of these makeup items, we were required to buy some. So without getting a salary of any kind, and so I was required to buy some of this makeup and then wear it. The guys got the day off. Started my career also in 2-inch heels that we were required to wear. We talked about them as our concourse shoes. By that time, at least the union had been successful in saying we need aisle shoes and concourse shoes. So everyone, all the women would bring two sets of shoes, and you'd wear your concourse shoes through the airport, and then you'd switch into your aisle shoes for on the plane that would be flats and save your feet a little bit.
And this is 1996.
1996.
Right? I mean, this isn't like 1950.
No, yeah. But in 1993, that was the last time that flight attendants had to step on a weight scale when they came to work.
Wow.
So it had only been a few years since that was in place.
Yeesh. And why did you? When you were on the concourse, you weren't working, correct?
No, but passengers could see me and they could see everything. And it's actually harder to see flight attendants' feet when they're working on the plane because you have to really work at looking over into the aisle. But when we're walking through the concourse, the airline wanted to have a certain look. This was, you know, not that long since they were putting up ads that said things like "I'm Cheryl, fly me to Mexico," and really used flight attendants as a marketing tool and sold sex.
And what else did they do? You had makeup day. Did you have hair day?
I think makeup and hair day might have been the same day.
When did they get rid of high heels on the concourse?
I think we got that done actually during the bankruptcy. I have a great story about that, actually.
So what year is it?
So that fight, I think, was 2003.
Okay. So you make it through the training. Where do you get domiciled then? Where do you start out from?
They sent me to Boston. Boston had recently opened, so there were there was about 100 flight attendants who were very senior who had been commuting from Boston for a very long time and suddenly were able to fly out of their home base. But then they were filling Boston with new hires. So because of that, I was one of the first classes. I was the first full training class to be sent to Boston. And there were several that came behind us. And so when I got there, we did one of the last days of training. The credit union came in, signed us all up for an account. That's where we were getting our paychecks. And also they would give a loan of $1,000 to new hires because we had not been paid at all, but they were going to give us this loan to get started flying. We were also required to pay for our uniforms. So, So we were sent to Boston. The union contract said that we got a week in a hotel. Because we actually did not enforce that, so we shared rooms. It was supposed to be single rooms. There was no one really looking out for that, and the airline got away with what they could, but the union had negotiated for us at least that we would get this hotel room for a week. But you were sent to these cities that maybe you'd never been to before, and you were expected to have accommodations and the ability to answer the phone and get to the airport in a couple hours, within a week. And typically also during that week, you were already getting an assignment. So you might have been gone for a few days during the time that you had your week in the hotel. And it wasn't until about 3 weeks into the job that my roommates, we did find an apartment. It was we signed the lease before they had finished doing the work on it in the north end of Boston. It's two stops from the airport. And our union contract did also get us a T pass, a subway pass to get back and forth to the airport, thank goodness. But we it was seven of us in this small apartment in the north end. And all my roommates got their paycheck, and I didn't. My paycheck didn't drop into my bank account. So I went into the office and asked what the issue was. And the person behind the desk said, well, people get their first paychecks at different times for different reasons. We're sure you get it next time. And I remember thinking in my head, I have $12 in my account. I have no idea how I'm going to make ends meet, but I'm on probation. You just need to like suck it up and figure it out. And so I left and, prayed for the phone to call so that I would get a flight assignment and I could at least eat some plain food. If I'm being really honest, I would try to work first class so that I could get a few dates. That those were steak and lobster nights, but then I somehow made it through those 2 weeks. It filled in the gaps with Top Ramen, because I could have one of those for 10 cents. And then got to the next payday. And while I was waiting for the paycheck to drop, because this wasn't in the day when it came in at midnight, I took a flight to Chicago and back, the early flight to Chicago and back, so I could eat some more plain food. Because no one was at home in my house. We didn't have any food in the cupboards. And so when I landed in Boston, I checked my bank account and there's nothing in it. I went down into the office right away and said, okay, this can't be right. I didn't get my paycheck again. And I started to get some of the same response. Oh, people get their first paychecks at different times for different reasons. And I realized for the first time, oh my God, this is what it means to just be a number. And it was really the first time in my life that I had ever had that experience. And I became pretty desperate, and I started to get more excited than someone on probation should. And the tears started to come because rent was due the next day. It wasn't just for me, my roommates were counting on me too. And so I had this tap on the shoulder, and I turned around, and there's someone standing there who looks a lot like me. She's wearing the same uniform. I do remember her AFA pin right above her wings. And she said, she asked me how to spell my name. She handed me a check for $800. And she said, number one, you go take care of yourself. And number two, you call our union. And I did have my paycheck the next day, but I always tell everyone that that was the moment when I was hooked on our union, because I learned that in our union, we're never alone. And through our union, we can be organized about the care that we have for each other and make the most out of it.
So you literally got on a plane, flew to Chicago, not working, just
Jump
taking free
seating.
flight benefit. Yeah, jump seating, and then jump seating back so that you'd have something to eat.
Yes.
I mean, that's incredible. I mean, it's just like, what, 7, 8 hours of time
Yeah.
to grab a meal,
Yeah.
basically. Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And at the time, we still had to wear our uniform if we were jump seating.
Jump seating. Yeah.
I didn't have my flight benefits yet, so I had
Yeah.
to sit on that jump seat, and
Yeah.
Passengers also assumed I was working and
Sure.
wondered why I was sitting there.
So,
This
do you
was the day when the airline still served meals.
Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
right.
Correct, correct.
Do you remember the name of the flight attendant that was behind you at the desk there?
Kathleen Callahan.
Oh, no kidding. Wow. And
I
so,
didn't.
go ahead. No,
I
no.
well, I didn't know her name until she handed me her check.
Yeah.
But
Wow.
yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. What a
And
great
when you
story.
started, then there wasn't a orientation from the union to sign you up?
There was an orientation from the union, and they even took us on a trolley ride around Boston. I mean, we've got the most incredible welcome from the union, but they didn't think to tell us about when we get our paychecks. They didn't think ahead to the problems we might have, and I didn't have any experience with unions, so it didn't occur to me to call the union from the start. That just was not something that had been had sunk in yet. I had just thought, these are the people that I have a good time with.
And am I correct that in the airlines, every flight attendant, if you're in a bargaining unit, has to be a member?
There's yes, right to
So
work
they didn't have
laws.
to sign you up.
Well, they do. Technically, you have to sign a membership application, and you also have to sign a form if you're going to have dues check off, if you're going to have dues deducted from your paycheck, which is the easiest way to pay your dues and the way that the union tries to sign everyone up. So there was an orientation at we had negotiated it in the United contract years earlier for a 2-hour introduction from the union on one of your last days of training in Chicago. So I had
But
done that.
I'm sorry, keep going. Just to be clear then, everybody who is a flight attendant for United has to be a member of the union. You can't opt out.
You can opt out, but you're going to be an agency fee payer.
Okay.
And everyone signs up because if you're going to be paying dues, or they're not called dues, they're fees at that point. And of course, there's a slight discount, but for the most part, everyone wants to be a part of the union. And I have to say that I got quite an education in Boston when I first started because it had been 11 years since the 1985 pilot strike, where our union, the flight attendants, went out on a sympathy strike, legal under the Railway Labor Act, with the pilots. And there were people who still carried scab lists as if the strike had been the week before. So it was very much, if you were not a member of the union, if you were not wearing your union pin, you were in jeopardy of being ostracized from the whole crew. And so it was very clear that it was important to be a part of the union. I had to learn more what that meant, and as I spent time with people on the job, I learned what that meant. But coming into this, I didn't have any background of what it meant to be a union member.
So Kathleen lights this spark in you for trade unionism. How does that grow from there? How does that become the flame that it is today?
There's a few other things that happened, and because I had called the local for help, they called me and said, "Hey, would you like to volunteer to do union work? We could actually use someone who would be willing to do the new hire presentations when new hires come to Boston." And I, of course, said, "Yes, well, this should never happen to anyone else. Of course, I'm going to do this." And I also had no idea that people said no to these things. But I was very, very honored that they were asking me. And so we got there. My class had arrived on October 16th. By Christmas, my roommates were teasing me that I was the union girl and actually had created two earrings out of our union pin. And that was my present that they gave me for Christmas. In that short of amount of time, I was getting razzed as the radical union girl.
Very cool. And so from there, what's your first I mean steward's position or sort of
The
regular
election.
position?
So
Go
we
ahead.
were already in contract negotiations. We had had there was a failed TA just before I got on the property. It was about a year later that we negotiated the next TA. I thought that the contract stunk. By that time, I was doing the new hire presentations, and I had also taken on the communications chairperson position. And I had been and on my probation exit interview was also the day a day of picketing. So I did my probation exit interview and then went out and led cheers on the picket line. And some of the flight attendants started calling me Sarah DeMouth. That was my nickname. And so when the contract came out 6 months later, I looked at it and I thought, this is not what I was expecting. And worked very hard to get it voted down. I think it passed by one percentage point. But my work in Boston meant that we turned out an 80% no vote. People were very angry. I mean, it was a smaller base, so it didn't have as much of an impact, but I had already learned how to organize pretty well. In fact, actually, the company tried to fire me during that time because I had used company communications to encourage people to vote no. And the local president said to the company, "Well, if you're going to fire her, then you have to fire all the people who sent messages saying to vote yes." And so I remember that very clearly and that experience. I also remember going out on that picket line, and we were marching in front of the doors that were sort of the automatic sliding doors, and it opened into this atrium in Boston Terminal C that had very high ceilings. And so as we were shouting and the doors would open, it would echo into the entire terminal. And so the management came out to complain about this and got the police and said, this isn't right. And I remember standing there right next to the local president, and he said, "Well, I'd love to get them under control, but they're just very angry. I can't." And so I remember taking all of this in and saying, "Oh, I see how this works. Like, we can have a lot of fun." So anyway, I'd gotten very into like, this is what we do. This is what we're going to fight for. And I had all the strike stories too, and really embraced this whole idea of taking on the company and getting what was our due. And so I went to the union meeting after the contract had been voted in, and people were angry and they're throwing down their union pins, and I'm thinking, oh, that looks good. And then what happened in the middle of that union meeting for me was that Kathleen flashed in front of my face. And I thought about her, and I thought about all the people that I had met on the jump seat and on the planes, and incredible people. And I thought, well, this is our union. We're just gonna fix it. So I got more involved, and I was definitely a dissident voice. And by that time, we had already had an election, so I was now what you call a council rep in AFA, might be like a union steward in another union. And had been doing grievances and started to get trained in all of our different committees, the hotel committee, the occupational committee, the scheduling committee. I kind of flunked out of that one. Let other people handle that. But would give a lot of my days off in the union office answering the phone and helping people every single day. And this was all volunteer work. But then I would go to the national meetings and, always have some very harsh words for everyone. And what are we doing? And so they kept giving me one job after another until actually they made me the national strike chair during the proposed United US Airways merger that was going to create a unilateral change to our contract. So we were saying that we would have the right to strike if they move forward without negotiating with us. And so turned out, a very strong strike vote at the time. The company also tried to fire me once again because I was in the lounge talking to people about the strike vote. And they So they sent the supervisor to give me a direct order to leave. And I said, well, I'll leave today, but this is my right to be here. And so you better get it together because I'm coming tomorrow. And came back. And I remember the supervisor's running and said, she's here, she's here. And there was so much fear. And here I was just this, I knew who I was this non-threatening, but clear about my rights and about justice, and they were terrified, and so I made them give me a direct order and essentially and went through this whole process where the company ultimately did not fire me because they didn't I don't think that they wanted to create a martyr, but they gave me a suspension, and we filed in federal court to fight that. And we had the court hearing on September 7th of 2001, and the court accepted the case, which was the first big hurdle. And ultimately, because September 11th happened 4 days later, we ultimately ended up settling, of course, affirming all of our federal rights and the ability to talk with our fellow coworkers in non-work areas at non-work times about anything, including a strike vote. So that all led up to 9/11, when we were also in
Can
the
I
middle of.
stop you?
Yes.
9/11 is a big topic. So
Yeah.
you mentioned a few things that are different in the under the Railway Labor Act that I wanted to slow down about. First of all, you were on strike, you were taking a strike vote.
We took a strike vote
Don't
to.
you have to go through a whole process before you can take a strike vote?
Well, you can essentially take a strike vote anytime you want to. The union calls the strike vote. That doesn't necessarily mean that then you're right on strike. It just authorizes the strike from the members. And then there would be the process to determine when the legal strike deadline would be. In this case, what we were saying was that this would be a unilateral change to the contract. And so it's another provision of the law. It's not a normal negotiations strike deadline that goes through all of the procedures to try to get to that right to strike. If the company moved forward without negotiating with and created this unilateral change, we were arguing that we had the legal right then to strike. And
And the
so this was the threat in order to get them to negotiate with us.
merger had already occurred.
No. So the merger never happened. Actually, we
Right.
killed the merger. We were opposed to the merger as well, but we were saying if the merger was going to go forward, it was going to create this unilateral change, which means that they needed to negotiate with us. So because the merger never happened, none of that ever came to fruition, but that was all still in play, actually. It hadn't completely died out before 9/11.
Okay, and then the other, when they suspended you, disciplined you, you said you went to court.
The union went to court.
Help me out here, Jeff. That's different than under the National Labor Relations Act, correct?
Yes,
Yes.
absolutely.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
in under the Railway Labor Act, you have a grievance and then you go to court.
Under the Railway Labor Act, everything is remanded to arbitration unless it is a major dispute. And so that first hurdle of determining that this was a major dispute, a major violation of our federal rights, essentially, the court did determine prior to September 11th that this was a major dispute, and the court was accepting the case. So that we would have had to go through the same sort of process on what I'm talking about with the merger that would have created this unilateral change, which the Railway Labor Act does speak to impact bargaining. So it's just rarely triggered because airlines don't typically take on a big fight like that or make a big change that would trigger something that would qualify as a major dispute.
And ultimately, US Airways merged with American, correct?
Yes, later.
Okay.
Much, much later. Yes.
So in hindsight, would it have been better for them to merge with United, do you think, or?
Oh God, I'm tortured with that almost every day.
Yeah.
maybe so, but
Yeah.
at the time
Sure. No, that's
we were simply opposed to any merger, frankly. And one of the arguments that we had made against deregulation was that it would lead to consolidation, and that all this choice that was supposedly going to happen would be taken away anyway.
Why were you opposed to that merger?
Well, first of all, we saw this as an opportunity. When I talked about the contract that was barely voted in, that contract was a 10-year contract. And so here was an opportunity for us to actually negotiate some improvements that otherwise we wouldn't have had the chance to negotiate for another 5 years at that point. So there was that. But also, United Airlines flight attendants did have this idea that we were the premier airline in the industry. And one of the ways that the airlines would keep workers from creating solidarity is to make them feel like the workers are different. Or in different classes, or so I have to say that one of the reasons that we were opposed to it was very much falling prey to some of the corporate narrative about being a different type of worker.
So all that aside, 9/11 hits then. So I mean, more than any other group of people or industry, the impact it had on the AFA was just incredible. Can you walk us through a little bit of that experience?
Yeah, so I had just landed in Chicago that morning from the West Coast. I had gone out to the West Coast to see friends.
And you're still domiciled in Boston at the time, right? Which is,
Yes. I went directly from DC, where we were in court arguing on the crew room issue. Out to the West Coast for a day or two. And then I had a union training for the occupational committee on September 11th. It was scheduled for that day. And so I had taken the all-nighter. I went to the Hilton Fitness Center. The Hilton was connected to O'Hare. And because I had about 4 hours before I was supposed to be at the training and I didn't already have a hotel room, this was a union event, not my flight attendant gig. If it had been a flight attendant working trip, I would have been able to go get a hotel, but I knew I wasn't going to be able to go anywhere to lay down for a little bit. And I also knew that at the Hilton, there was a massage table that wouldn't be used for several hours. And I had gotten to know the staff very well. Because I had worked turns to Chicago purposely the summer before so that I could go work out for the 3 hour sit that we were in Chicago. So I knew all of them. I knew that they would give me the massage table to sleep on, and that's what I went to go do. And the one of the staff at the fitness club came in and woke me up and said, Sarah, I'm sure you'd want to know, a plane just flew into the World Trade Center. And I was like, what? Okay. And so I got out of the room and went into the main part of the fitness center, and I'm staring up at the TV, and now all the cameras are trained on the World Trade Center, and I watched what I learned later was Flight 175 fly into the South Tower. And I had just I had worked the flight a week earlier. It was a favorite trip in Boston. Transcons were the sort of the most senior trips. You could be very efficient one flight and then have a 24 hours in San Francisco or LA. And I knew everyone on the plane, and I also knew that my best friend who called me from Miami Beach. Now we were in Boston together, and I had been bidding for her, and I had been bidding that flight. So at the moment in the fitness center, I didn't know any of that. I just knew that, okay, this is not some accident now. Like this is a big deal, and I need to get to the union office right now. And we didn't even know, they had still been saying that the first plane was maybe a Cessna. Nobody really knew what was going on yet. Actually, as I was standing there, I remember there was reporting from the Pentagon, and the reporter said, it sounds like a bomb has gone off at the Pentagon. And so I got on the hotel van that took us over to the hotel that we stayed at, but also was right next to the union office. And I remember just like sobbing on the van, because I knew at this point we're under attack. I knew that my life was, my world was changing. I didn't know how much yet, but got into the union office, and it was just a normal morning for everyone in there. And I said, you have to turn on the TV. And our officers were not there because they had already been called by United Airlines, and they had gone straight to the crisis room at United Airlines. We learned very soon after that. And so there I am in the National Union office, and we were having briefings every 15 minutes. We were pulling all of the crew lists from all the planes that we knew were in the air, trying to track down where everyone was, and then getting briefings as intelligence was coming in. And the American Flight 11 was identified fairly early. So already I knew, I mean, that was just so close to home. But I remember standing in the vice president's office for one of these 15-minute briefings, and hearing Flight 175, and everything started to go dark. And one of the women who had not necessarily been very friendly towards me as this young yippie dissident in the union. She had never even said hello to me before. Caught me and held me, stayed with me for the rest of the day, and sort of became my mother in that moment. I knew that I needed to just be with my friends. I found some two people who wanted to get back to Boston. We rented a car, and we started driving back to Boston. There were no flights. I remember driving. We just kept driving together, and we had a rule that we would not turn on the radio. We could only talk about happy things. We could only and so if anything started to turn, it was a rule that we had to talk about something happy. And every overpass that we went under had an American flag on it already. We were only out on the road with trucks. There was no vacationers. Nobody was, on the road for any other reason. And I remember driving into Boston, and realizing there's no planes in the air, which was very strange. Because I had lived near the airport, and that's all I had known in Boston. And we got straight over to the crisis room at the Hilton at the airport. It was a brand new hotel at the time. Got into our crisis room, where there were 100 flight attendants there. At the time, the base was about, it had grown quickly to about 800 flight attendants at the time. And we were focused on getting everyone home, and it took 6 days to get all the crews back into Boston. They were stranded all over the world. And we would go, the airport was shut down. They were only taking incoming flights. There were no flights taking off or departing during most of that week. And we would go with American flags and greet the passengers, singing patriotic songs as they were coming off the planes. And then it's sitting in the crisis room, and we would have gatherings. We were calling people at home, telling them to come because people were in shock sitting at home. I remember the suicide calls that we got, and the people who had, been in recovery for a long time and were drinking again and or finding some other way to kill the pain. And there was a lot at stake. And then very quickly, there were the announcements about the furloughs too. We planned a crew member memorial in Boston that 40,000 people came to, and it was for with we did this with the American Airlines flight attendants too. My friend Robert Fangman, who was on flight 175 and had the same birthday I had only been flying for 8 months. Because I was doing the new hire presentations, I knew all the new hires. I had been there. I remember that he came out with us that night after his orientation, and he got the word that he was released from reserve the next day. So we stayed out all night. We bowled. He went back and crashed on my couch. We were very close, and we would joke every time we saw each other and say, "You're the wind beneath my wings," and we would run into each other's arms. And he had come from finance, but for the first time, he was able to live his life openly as a gay man, and he loved it. He said, I've never been at home, and I feel at home here. I said in the crisis room to everyone, I said, "We have to have Bette Midler come and sing at the memorial." And they said, "Sarah, you're crazy. Like, we've got enough to do. What are you doing?" But I said, "Flight attendants are amazing. Somebody's going to know like how to get in touch with Bette Midler, and I'm sure if we just let her know, she'll come." And so I asked everyone who came into our crisis room, "Do you know how we can get in touch with Bette Midler?" And literally, I mean, the other reps were like shaking their heads. And within an hour and a half, a flight attendant said, "Oh yeah, I used to be Steven Spielberg's personal assistant. I'll call Steven." And so he did, and within an hour we were in touch with Bette Midler and made plans for her to come. She refuses to she's scared to fly, so we had to get Amtrak to have a whole car dedicated to her. She had to have her backup singers and her musicians and her we set up this whole thing. We got everybody to donate everything, and then we got word that she would only stay at a Four Seasons. So I went to the Four Seasons, and I said, "I can't tell you who," because we didn't want this to be about her either. We wanted it to be about the cruise, so we wanted it to be a surprise. And I said, "I can't tell you who, but a celebrity is coming for this big event, and will you donate these rooms?" And they said no. And so then I went and I got, the other big name hotels. I went and got them to agree to do it, and I went back to the Four Seasons, and I said, "The Globe is only one phone call away. How do you want this to go?" And so they said, "Fine, we'll give you the rooms." So anyway, we did all of this. We had the crew memorial. Bette Midler came out. Robert's family was standing in front of me. They turned around and said, "We saw this on the program, but that's Bette Midler." And I said, "Yeah. She came from Robert." So we did that. We had the each of the crew members symbolized by a rose and the uniform behind them. Those roses went on a special flight down to New York, and we had a burial ceremony down at Ground Zero. But then that crisis room turned into a furlough support room because 20% of the flight attendants were furloughed almost immediately in Boston, because that had been a very junior base. That meant half of our base was facing furlough. And these were the roommates of our crew members and people who were, trying to figure out their lives. And about 3 weeks in, I worked my first flight after 9/11. And I remember sitting in the back of the airplane. And we didn't have new procedures in place yet. But the crew member that I was working with, we decided together that we were not going to take off in our normal brace position, but that we were going to take off with our hands around our neck. And that way, if someone reached around and tried to slit our throats, they would get our hands and not our throats. And that's how, people were coping and trying to think about how to remain safe. And everyone was on alert. And We had to get new procedures in place. And of course, no one wanted to fly. Everyone was scared to fly. That led to then all the bankruptcies, and United Airlines being the longest one, 38 months long in bankruptcy. We were successful in getting the bankruptcy law changed for other airline bankruptcies, but not for United. And we fought them every which way we could. At this point now, I was elected to serve as the national communications chairperson, and essentially then was posted up in Chicago, even though I was still based in Boston, still had a place in Boston. But that first year of the bankruptcy, I spent 12 nights in my bed in Boston. And otherwise, I was in Chicago working around the clock, dealing with more furloughs, dealing with base closures, dealing with emergency pay cuts, and then the fulsome Section 1113, very painful contract cuts that were across the board. And got rid of, I should just make this note, the very first contract negotiated for a flight attendant was in 1946. And one of the four major pillars that we got in that contract, including a double-digit raise, a seniority list so that managers could no longer try to coerce flight attendants to trade sex for schedules, and an 8-hour day and a cap on the number of hours that we could fly. Both that cap and that 8-hour day were taken in that bankruptcy process.
So how do you recover from that then? Talk about, I mean, and you're on this trajectory as well at the same time within the union. So talk about how those two sort of relate to each other and going forward.
Yeah, so the bankruptcy started December 9th, 2002. So here I was working around the clock, and we had already been working because we had put in for the Air Transportation Stabilization Act loan guarantee that was denied by the Bush White House towards United Airlines after all the unions had agreed to take pay cuts too, much like they required in 2008 of the auto workers, and then they denied that, and of course then we're in bankruptcy and the cuts are much steeper, and United waited so long to file for bankruptcy that the cash flow was so low that the threat of liquidation was very serious. And we got a space on the creditors committee, so we know exactly what was going on. The bondholders were advocating for liquidation. They would have gotten more out of it. We had the very rich routes that were worth nothing at that time because no one was flying. We had no cash. We had no way really to raise money. No one wanted to give money to airlines either. And then we had the operational performance of the airline, which everyone said was going to be terrible because morale was going to be terrible. Well, it was only the employees that saved United Airlines because it was the only metric that was good in that creditors committee and gave just enough of an argument to get debtor in possession lending to keep the airline going and go through the entire bankruptcy process. But there was the first big round of cuts. That first big round of cuts included a change to our retiree health care. One of the big things that we did was make sure that there would be a 6-week window where flight attendants could retire under the old retiree health care provisions because there were so many people who really sort of were keeping the job only because they had very serious health conditions. And 2,600 flight attendants decided to retire during that time, which was more than had retired in the entire history of United Airlines. And so then 3 months later, the CFO said, "Oh, we made an accounting error, and now we're going to have to use the provision in the bankruptcy code that allows us to cancel retiree health care." So we put up a big fight. What was happening at the same time, actually, was because AFA had lost 20% of our membership, 20% of our revenue overnight, that there was an effort going on with our national office to try to find a merger partner and to try to work to find another union that we could merge with because we had lost all this revenue and our expenses were more than they had ever been, having to defend all of these workers in all these different bankruptcies. So we talked with several unions. We talked with ALPA, who basically said, "We don't want you back." We talked with the machinists. We talked with SEIU. We talked with a few others, and we talked with CWA. And CWA was the only union that would confirm that we could keep our identity, and our own decision making, and that also agreed to sort of cover the rest of our expenses for a period of 4 years, so that we were not having to go to the members with a dues increase. Now, I have to be honest, I worked very hard against approval of the merger. I wanted to retain our union, but it did pass. There was a full membership vote, and it passed by a slim margin. But on the ballot, it was, do you want to pay $6 more in dues, or do you want to merge with CWA? And looking back on it, it was a really good fit. CWA wanted to have the credibility of having a union that was used to working with the RLA for organizing the agents and other workers in the airline industry. And for us, we were merging with a union that had fought many of the same battles we fought with telecom, with telephone operators who, reading the description of their job, and I would do this actually at many of the new hire presentations, sounded very much like the description of a flight attendant. So there was actually, a shared history there too. But this coming back to this retiree healthcare fight, we were in the middle of that right as we were consummating the marriage, and we were signed up for the defense fund. And before we had even made a first dollar of deposit into the defense fund from the dues, we put forward an application to help us fight this termination of retiree healthcare. And so we got a defense fund grant in order to do that. And the idea was that we would get radio ads, we would get print ads, and we would get billboards. And so I was charged with implementing this plan. And half of the newspapers in the country just refused our business because they didn't want to take on United Airlines. They didn't have to say that, but it was very obvious. And most of the billboards were owned by Clear, and they had no interest in helping workers. So we had to do some very watered down thing that was like retiree healthcare matters, as opposed to the very strong message that we wanted to have. But in the newspapers, we were going to run these full-page ads in all these newspapers across the country, including USA Today, on a Sunday that January or February in 2004. And the Friday before these were supposed to run, the San Francisco Chronicle called us, where we had bought ad space, and they said, "No, sorry. We must have screwed up, but we don't have room for your ad." And so there were guild members who worked at the San Francisco Chronicle. So we called the local steward for the guild, and a few of the guild members got around a water cooler and started speaking very loudly about the fact that, "Did you hear that 200 flight attendants are going to be down here at the San Francisco Chronicle this Sunday, picketing over the Chronicle's refusal to, to allow them to use their free speech rights, And so the marketing department called us back within an hour and said, "Oh, we found space to run your ad." So here we had this, I think we had $250,000 in this defense fund plan. We bought these ads all over. We had, "If retiree healthcare matters, send us an email here." So it ran in all these newspapers nationwide. The same weekend, we had retirees out at the airports picketing. I mean, ragtag group of like 12 retirees here, it was not that big a deal. We got one email from all of those ads. But we learned the real power of being connected with workers everywhere, to be in every space, to share the workers' message, and then also those we got barely any exposure with the paid for ads, but the picketing got us a front page story on USA Today and the Chicago Tribune. The Chicago Tribune, who had refused our business for the ad too. So it was a real lesson in solidarity, but also in the value of workers coming together in a union, even when you maintain the very focused efforts on the specific jobs, but understanding that our fight is the same.
So how does the retiree healthcare battle shake out?
Oh, well, we won. So we got a negotiated settlement that increased the cost of the retiree healthcare by 10 times. But what that means is that retirees went from paying $10 a month for their health insurance to $100 a month, which was a lot on a fixed income, but certainly not the unlimited amount that it was going to go to. And all of those retirees were able to maintain that healthcare.
Right. Good story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we had the same fight with the pensions, and I'll just do that one a little bit faster. But we had to try to help people understand the importance of the pensions. So we spent a year educating on the importance of the pensions. And instead, people were arguing that we needed to focus on shoes. And because they did not want to wear uncomfortable shoes, and they wanted to be able to wear dance go shoes like nurses wear, because we were having to work more. I mean, this became an even more of an issue than it had ever been.
Right.
And so I remember getting so angry and thinking, they're holding the planes together with duct tape, for God's sakes. Like, just wear your comfortable shoes and tell the supervisors to go stuff it, right? Get out on the picket lines for our pensions. But, you know, people were not ready to hear that. And so we put together a petition. We ran a whole issue campaign in the course of a month. We were very quick about it. We got the airline to change the shoe policy. And then we had everyone's attention. And they knew that they could make change, you know, within their workplace. We finally had people paying attention again. Prior to that, everybody was in shock. And it was only because of our union we were able to fight and do anything. But now we had the members with us for the end of this fight. And that is then when we took another strike vote to try to preserve our pensions. We were the only union that ended up fighting for our pensions. And ultimately, the court allowed termination when $80 million would have saved the pensions. Just a few months later, the court approved $400 million for the executives in that bankruptcy. But what we did was we generated enough power to have Barack Obama serve as a mediator, to call the CEO of United Airlines to his office. And he mediated the settlement between United and the union for double what the company wanted to pay for a pension replacement plan.
Wow.
Barack as senator or as president?
Senator.
Now, from Illinois.
From Illinois.
Yeah, right.
Yes. And, you know, and there's a lot of stories in that too. I mean, we protested Durbin and Obama and tried to get them to introduce legislation. That legislation would have been dead on arrival. We got it passed in the House, even with I mean, at the time, the Republicans had the trifecta. They had the White House and they had both chambers of Congress. And even with that, with George Miller and Jan Schakowsky, we put up a huge fight. We had the very first ever online congressional hearing. We submitted 10,000 stories of testimonies from flight attendants about what this would mean. And we encouraged all the other work groups to submit stories too about what the termination of these pensions would mean. And we actually won the vote in the House to save our pensions. But no one would introduce the legislation in the Senate. Finally, Teddy Kennedy did. He said it would be more important for it to come from Illinois, and it would have been. And so we were trying to push Durbin and Obama to do that. But what we were able to do was push Obama to serve as mediator for these discussions that otherwise probably wouldn't have come to conclusion. And we may have ended that bankruptcy without any replacement retirement plan if we had not generated that kind of power and attention.
What year was the end of the bankruptcy?
The bankruptcy ended February 2nd, 2006.
And all this time, you are communications chair for all of AFA?
For all of AFA United. And
United.
yes, and
And
because
that's
we
a elected position. It's not a staff position. Am I correct?
it's an elected position, yeah. Yep.
So,
And I was also serving as our strike chair again.
so 23-year-old Sarah would have been very proud of you protecting that pension.
23-year-old Sarah never would have imagined that I would have been working that hard. But it really, it was those first 6 months of that bankruptcy. The call from the company at one point when we already had 7,000 people out on furlough to call with another 2,500 furloughs. I mean, I can pinpoint the exact moment that I knew how I was going to spend my life. Because I just, you know, I was reporting bad news every single day. And I realized that the deck was completely stacked against us, but we had to fight to hang on to everything we possibly could in order to live to fight for what we were truly due. Because I was still coming off of that first contract that I didn't like and I wanted to push forward. And so actually, I feel like we're finally in the moment right now. That we're really able to push forward on the career.
It's interesting. I've taken a few flights over the past month, and all United, because they used to have a hub here in Cleveland, and everybody to a person is wearing their AFA pin or their AFA lanyards. I mean, my wife kids me because for years I've been giving away a Starbucks gift card to any flight attendant wearing an AFA pin. So when I get on, if I see an AFA, I see an AFA and pin, we're in the same union. Here, have a cup of coffee on me. And my wife says, we're spending way more on Starbucks these days than we did in the past because everybody on the flights has AFA paraphernalia that
Yeah,
they're sporting.
you might have to move to Hershey's Kisses.
Maybe. Yeah.
I just
They don't travel as well as the Starbucks gift cards.
true, true, true.
I just have to get this on the record. Who was president of AFA when the merger happened?
Pat Friend.
And she remained the president of AFA and then a CWA vice president, I guess, of the sector for a number of years, correct?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, it's interesting because the merger agreement doesn't talk about the AFA president being a vice president at all. And in fact, just sort of like CWA Canada, or the News Guild, it's the AFA CWA president that's a member of the executive board.
And I think
So,
when she joined, she may have been at that point, along with Barbara Easterling, the only other woman.
I think that may be right.
I can't remember when, if the Guild had already come in, then you had Linda Foley.
No, that's right. The Guild was in, I think, 2 years before us. So Linda Foley was on the board. It's also why, actually, after we split from ALPA, we were no longer a part of the AFL-CIO, but we got our charter with the AFL-CIO in, I believe it was 1983. And one of the reasons that we not only got a charter and then the AFA president served as a general board member, but we were put on the AFL-CIO Executive Council because the AFA president had always been a woman and they were looking to diversify the council at least a little bit, even if in name only, if not, yeah, if not
So,
fully in the spirit yet.
when do you decide to run for president of AFA? And how does that come about?
Yeah. So after we exited bankruptcy and we were in the mode of fighting United all the time, in 2008, I should go back. I helped with the election to bring Northwest flight attendants back into AFA in 2006. Help them get set up, help them through their bankruptcy. And then, of course, we all worked very hard to get Obama elected. Because one of the big things that we wanted to do was to change the rules at the National Mediation Board under the RLA that no longer would a non-vote be counted as a no vote in a union organizing election, which was a big deal for organizing Delta Airlines. And so, sort of coming off of the Northwest bankruptcy and then understanding that the plan for the Delta bankruptcy and merger was actually to purchase Northwest and create this new airline. We knew also that we would have this big fight to try to keep the Northwest contract. And so all of that was sort of happening in the background. But I got pregnant in 2008 and gave birth September. And actually marched in the inaugural parade, not knowing I was pregnant yet, but I was. And then gave birth September 14th of 2009. And I always laugh about that because I thought about having another child so I could have a couple days off in the hospital. So had my maternity leave, and towards the end of my maternity leave, I got a call from two mentors of mine in AFA, and they encouraged me to run for national office. And I said, "Oh, okay. Well, when is that? Next year?" And they said, "No, it's in 4 months, Sarah." So then, while I was breastfeeding, I was out running around the country, also campaigning to become AFA International Vice President. And I was elected. We were in the process of changing our budgeting year to CWA's budgeting year from June to the end of May from what we had been on with the calendar year, which meant that we were also changing our election cycle and all of that. So it was this very weird thing where we had an election and then we had an 8 month transition period. During that time, I sort of buttoned up what I had been doing with the United chapter of AFA and started to transition over the fall before I would become the international vice president on January 1st. And November 1st of that year is when we had the Delta election. So I had not directly worked on the campaign, but I was there the day and I was at the National Mediation Board when we got those results. And it was horrific. We got the exact number of votes that we had confirmed in the election, which is statistically impossible. I don't actually believe those election results. But we had confirmed 49.5% of the workers having voted for the union. And in the two prior elections, we had gotten anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000 votes that we couldn't confirm because there was so much fear spread at Delta. So we thought when we got to 49.5, there was no way we could lose. And I was there to see Northwest flight attendants, lose their contract and lose everything. And the Delta flight attendants who had been working so hard to try to gain their union, not achieve that. And then it was not long after that that the United Airlines, actually the United Airlines Continental merger had already been announced. I was put in charge of running our representation election there. It was the first thing that I did, with the exception of on the very first day I was in office, the president and I went to Phoenix to try to close out US Airways America West merger negotiations. We were off to the races. And we had the election for United on June 29th of 2011. So just 6 months into my term. I didn't sleep, and I remember, I'd have weekly meetings with Larry Cohen, and I remember him yelling at me in one of the meetings, saying, "This is going to define your whole life, Nelson. And you're gonna if you don't win this, you're gonna look back and you're gonna think nothing of yourself, nothing." And anyway, I remember it being very intense. And I did not sleep at all, but I was essentially running three different jobs. I would do in the morning, I would do the organizing, checking in with all the locations, checking in on their numbers, checking in with them on what the plan was for organizing that day. And then I would do all the external communications and internal communications for the union. And then at night, I would stay up doing social media as long as I could until I fell asleep, and was mostly sleeping about 2 hours a night. But we won that election. And then it was very difficult because at the time the machinists filed charges against us. It would be normally something that a company would do, but another union did it, and so kept the election results sort of hanging in the balance, kept people from fully committing to the fact that they're in a new union, and being able to negotiate with United Airlines over the merger terms. So there was a lot going on there, and we had a lot of conflict in the union after that. And we had lost Northwest, so now we had gained Continental, but we had lost Northwest. There was all this turmoil, and then shortly after that, the US Airways American merger was announced as well. And we had always hoped that the American Airlines flight attendants would join our union. They had, about the same time we left ALPA, they had left in a sort of amicable divorce with ALPA. They had a desert campaign against the Transport Workers Union and had taken on this identity of being an independent union and being that being their strength. And of course, it's tied to women being able to address the issues that we want to address at the table. So it was all about beating back the sexism that existed in the labor movement, too. Mm-hmm. But the consultants who worked with them had been able to put in $1 million invoices every year. And so they didn't want this independent union to merge with AFA ever. So even though we had had all these times when it was a very obvious fit, there was an effort to keep AFA from merging with APFA because they were afraid they were going to lose their invoices. So they would always make AFA the villain, not the company. Mm-hmm. And so we had another fight on our hands with the U.S. Airways and American merger. And I ran for president because, you know, our president decided not to fight that. And mm-hmm. our leadership wanted us to fight it. And the U.S. Airways members wanted us to fight for them. And so that's what was hanging in the balance. And what was also hanging in the balance was negotiations at United. That had been dragging on forever and not gotten to a conclusion. And now the CEO at United at the time was trying to get rid of the union for sure. They were actually furloughing on the United side and hiring on the Continental side. It was just a horrific condition. So all of these things were happening right around that election, and people encouraged me once again to run. Every single office I've ever ran for in AFA, it's been someone else's idea, not mine. Mm-hmm. It ultimately becomes my decision, but it usually wasn't my idea. And in the context of all of that is when I ran for president, and it was, it was a real contested election, and I ended up, ultimately, at the end of the day, I got 2/3 of the vote, but I had a union to put back together as president because there was a lot of infighting and a lot of dissension. And one of the first things that I had to do, because we had already, even though we made the deal better for U.S. Airways flight attendants, we had already lost the representation of the U.S. Airways flight attendants by the time I became president. So we had another year where we were negotiating with APFA and preserve their seniority, preserve their bargaining rights, but we had to give up representation. And so the first thing I had to do as AFA president was cut 20% of our staff because we were losing 20% of our revenue once again.
And we're coming up on 2 hours here, so I want to get just a couple of quick questions before we let you go. What do you see as the biggest challenges that you've got facing you right now as the president of AFA?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we have been able to do in recent years, and especially since the Me Too movement, and also the stance that we took in the government shutdown in 2019, it really propelled the public's view of a flight attendant in a very different way. Mm-hmm. And we ran a campaign as aviation's first responders and really worked at changing the view of flight attendants so that we could change We already knew our value, but so that we could change our value at the bargaining table. And so we were ready to go into negotiations in 2020 with all of this at our backs. And then COVID hit. And because we had been through the crisis before, we were not going to go through that again. I remember March 5th was the day that Elizabeth Warren dropped out of the presidential race. She was the last woman standing. And I had worked very closely with her policy people during the course of the campaign. I knew all of them were looking for jobs, and they were in dire straits because here we were. We had this crisis now. There were not going to be jobs for anyone anywhere. So hired four of them. We put together a plan in the course of 4 hours that I sent over to Chairman DeFazio, Chairman of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee in the House. That was a Friday. By Sunday, he called me and said, Pelosi has accepted this as the foundation of the Democratic platform for the aviation industry. And then Mitch McConnell tried to hijack the process and put together a bill that was a big giveaway to corporations. So just 5 days later, I got a call from Senator Markey, who said, Sarah, you're going to be so proud. Every Democrat is standing together, and we have denied Mitch McConnell the ability to move forward with this plan. I give credit to Nancy Pelosi, too, because she came screeching across the country and, you know, ran into that Senate caucus room and told them what they needed to do. And but then we had a fighting chance. And in the meantime, what had happened was that the CEOs were not getting anywhere with their efforts to try to get relief. Because everybody was mad at the airlines after all this consolidation, the addition of fees, the fact that you could see inequality when you walked on an airplane. So what people were experiencing in their own lives, they were seeing and experiencing visually when they would walk onto an airplane, as they'd go back to the back seat, and where maybe you're lucky if you can get your butt in there, but you don't get to bring your bag unless you pay another $50. So they were not getting a warm reception. And Doug Parker, who was CEO of American, who I had negotiated with in various different roles over a period of 20 years, called because Chairman DeFazio told them, I'm not going to talk to you until you talk to labor. And they said, well, what do you mean? We need to call Rich Trumka. And DeFazio said, no, you need to call Sarah Nelson. And so it took them another 2 days to fail on the Hill before they made that call. But Doug Parker did make that call. And on March 18th of 2020, I went down to the Airlines for America boardroom, where there were six CEOs sitting around the table. And I told them, yeah, you're not going to get anything. The public hates you for good reason. But we've got this plan that will save jobs. It'll save the industry. You're going to have to agree to ban stock buybacks and cap your own pay. Oh, and by the way, we want seats on your boards, and you can't change any contracts in bankruptcy. We did not come to an agreement on those two terms, or on the term that they couldn't spend any of the money on union busting. But we came to an agreement that night on the core terms that this would be payroll support that was essentially a pass through to the workers to stay in our jobs, no furloughs, and no pay cuts also was another important point. And they had to cap their pay and ban stock buybacks. So that was the agreement. We fought out the other provisions in the legislative process that took place over the next 5 days only. This is the CARES Act, probably the fastest piece of legislation ever moving. Mm-hmm. And we were the last in a $2 trillion deal. We were $25 billion and the last item on the table. At 6 in the morning, after McConnell and Schumer had already announced at 1 o'clock that they had a deal. So we got that through, and then we were able to, you know, fight to get it through another two times. The second time was while Trump was still president, and we had the presidential election and all kinds of things that got in the way of that. And when we got it done in December, we still had to have the president sign it. He was out on the golf course. And I mean, it just the amount of craziness around this after all of the work that flight attendants had done, going out in COVID, protesting at Senate district offices everywhere to try to get support. And now we had to count on Lindsey Graham convincing Trump that he should sign this piece of legislation. And basically, at the end of the day, told him you should sign it because the people all across America are going to get $600 checks with your name on them. And so we got that through a second time. And then Biden became president, and it took one phone call to the Biden administration to get it extended to the point that airlines said there will not be any furloughs. We're through COVID. We're through the threat, and we're moving on.
What an accomplishment. I mean, that's dramatic, if nothing else in your careers. That little vignette there is an amazing piece of work. So congratulations. So one of the things we've done with these histories, these interviews, is Hannah is she's not a CWA member, and so she listens to all of these, and she we give her an opportunity to ask a question as well, just because she's going to ask something that we wouldn't think of because she comes from a different place altogether, not to mention being generations younger. So Hannah, have you got something you want to ask Sarah?
So I have like a few small questions and then larger questions.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, so you mentioned you have a child, a son. Do you have other children?
No, just one kiddo.
Just one kiddo. And were you ever married?
Yes. We got married. We got married in the middle of the Northwest bankruptcy fight. We got married in Charlottesville. My husband at the time was the general counsel of AFA. And we had known each other for 10 years earlier. It wasn't until the middle of the United bankruptcy. I lost my dad. He lost his dad within months of each other. And even though we had worked together for many years at that point and long hours together, we had our first personal conversation after coming back, both of us coming back from those memorials and those events. And so we sort of secretly dated at the end of the United Airlines bankruptcy. In fact, I know the day that I fell in love with him, we were in the bankruptcy court and it was the day that the PBGC announced that they were taking the airline's side and that our plan to save our pensions was not going to move forward. And he, as an attorney there, got the word first, and I saw him very upset walk down the hall. And I ran after him and touched him on the arm, and he turned around and, you know, he's a strong German guy, raised in Ohio. I had not really ever seen emotion before, but he had a tear rolling down his face, and pardon me for the language, but he said, "They stole our fucking pensions." And the fact that he said "our," that was it for me.
He's a keeper.
Yep. Yep.
So my other small questions, can you just confirm? So you said your parents were Christian. Was it
Zionists
or scientists?
Scientists. Christian scientists.
Scientists. Okay.
Yes.
Christian scientists. This is a very small question, but I'm curious. Do you remember any of the makeup items they forced you to buy?
Yeah. I know for a fact they made me buy lip liner and eyeliner, and then a little foundation. And the reason that I really remember the lip liner and the eyeliner was because one of my trips with these two women who were perfectly coiffed at 4 a.m. after a very short night, I valued my sleep much more. So I thought I'll do my makeup on the bus. But they didn't want to turn the lights on. And here I was, the junior person, asking to turn the lights on. That wasn't going to happen. So I did my makeup in the bus with the lights out, and I mixed up the lip liner and the eyeliner, and I had red eyes and black lips. And so when we got out of the van, I said, "Where do you want me to work?" And they said, "Honey, we'll set up today. Why don't you go to the powder room?" And I walked in and saw I was the
kudos for them not saying the circus.
Exactly. Yeah. So yes, that's what I was. I remember for sure that's what I was required to buy.
Thank you. I guess I'll ask one more question, which is, you mentioned the Me Too movement and that changing the public's perception of flight attendants. Could you speak a little more about that?
Yeah. So also my first day on the job, a flight attendant pulled me aside after a conflict in the office about how we were going to work. And I was a reserve, so here I was being called out to work a trip last minute because another flight attendant had called in sick. It was a very senior trip. So I was working with these two 35-year flight attendants in 1996. They had been through it. And we also were the first group to beat smoking out of our workplace. We beat big tobacco, even over the objections of ALPA that wanted, the pilots wanted to continue to be able to smoke on the plane. And so she had a very raspy voice because she'd spent all those years with secondhand smoke. And she pulled me aside to try to explain what had just happened. And she said, "Listen, management thinks of us as their wives or their mistresses. And in either case, they hold us in contempt." I'm like, "Whoo, that's a lot at 23, fresh out of company training." And then she said, "Your only place of worth is with your fellow flying partners. And if we stick together, you wear your union pin, there's nothing we can't accomplish." And so I was attracted to the message of solidarity, but I thought about that conversation when the Me Too movement broke, because here I was, president of this union, the union that had been the little union that can, that takes on, anything if it's in our way, but we never expected anyone to open the door for us. We never expected. We had the pilots and the machinists when we went through the employee stock ownership plan, which we ultimately were not a part of because at the 11th hour they said they didn't want us to have a board seat because a woman should not be on the board. This is what we had fought through, and our and so when the Me Too movement broke, I thought about all of the sexual harassment that I had faced on the job. And I thought, well, I got to make sure that my experience is not just mine alone, because we didn't even talk about it. It just like it's what we lived with every single day. And I said to the our communication staff, "Watch out, the phone's going to start ringing." And they're like, "What do you mean?" I said, "They're going to start telling stories of people who face sexual harassment at work. How long do you think it's going to take them before they call the flight attendant union?" So I got out into the crew rooms and I was having conversations with flight attendants. And I said, "What do you experience? Do you experience this?" And we actually did do an official survey that determined that two-thirds of our members had experienced sexual harassment in just the year prior. One in five had experienced physical harassment of some kind in the prior year. But to a T, in this crew room, whether the flight attendant had been there for a couple months or 30 years, they said, "Yeah, we this is like part of our daily occurrence." And I said, "Okay, what do you do when it happens?" And they would all their first answer would be, "Oh, we tell them to stop, whatever." And I'm like, "Every time?" And then the real conversation would start and they would say, "No, we don't have time. Like, we got to keep moving. We have to de-escalate. If I do that, it might create a bigger problem." And I would say, "Do you report it to anyone?" And like, "Report it to who? Like, who's gonna care? This is," and so then the answer would come, "This is just part of the job." And so that was kind of painful actually to realize here I was, president of the union, with all of these people who were experiencing this every single day, and then also having experienced it myself, the way that that flight attendant had described it to me, having experienced it at the table, that contempt, it was pretty painful, and I realized that we have got to change the perception of who we are. We've got to tell this story. We have to make it not okay. And luckily, right at the same time, the Washington Post reached out and said, "We'd like you to write an op-ed about, what is the one thing that the airlines could do immediately to change the situation." And so I wrote an op-ed saying that, and also sent letters to all the CEOs at the same time saying, "You need to immediately denounce this industry's sexist past. You need to hold up flight attendants as safety professionals, and you need to announce that there is a zero tolerance policy at the airline for this kind of behavior for employees or passengers, right? And at the time, I had just beat the United Airlines CEO out of a great contract. We finally got that contract done at United to bring United and Continental together. And he respected me, and he responded and did it right away. And that started to change everything, because when the CEO did that, especially when we had to count on the pilots to report these things to the ground, he just told the pilots that this is a priority. You have to do this, which completely changed our relationship with the flight deck. It changed our relationship with the public. It changed our relationship to each other about how we would be very clear in supporting each other and talking about this and not accepting this kind of treatment, which I think was also a really important basis going into COVID and all that flight attendants dealt with on the planes. And it changed the discussion just around our jobs, and I think around jobs that had been traditionally held by women in general. So we took that moment and really used it. And then actually what happened, our work around that led to me getting the Drum Major for Justice Award from the AFL-CIO, which happened to have its celebratory dinner and awards night on day 30 of the government shutdown, which was the place where I gave the speech about calling on the entire labor movement to conduct a general strike in order to end the shutdown, and talked about the power of working people, how we had to stand up for each other, which then also led the New York Times to say that I was the most powerful flight attendant in the country, which at the time I hated, because I still was going to the place that I thought the people thought about flight attendants. So I thought they were making fun of us. Or are we losing everyone, Jeff? But then I realized it says flight attendants and power on the front page of the Sunday business section of the New York Times. And on page 4, there was a profile of the Delta Airlines CEO. I think all of that put us in a position to demand our full worth. And I looked forward to going into that bargaining, but we've got to make it stick now that we finally have the chance to address issues that we haven't been able to address in 20 years.
Sarah, this has been incredible.